The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child, first and always.
Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. So I've wanted to talk to a rheumatologist for a while now, and it's mostly been a matter of trying to find the right match of person and topics. And then I was doing my reading for MOC this month, and I thought, wait a minute, the rheumatologist on this Kawasaki disease update is Karen James. And Karen James is right here in Salt Lake City. Why am I not talking to her, A, offline, and B, why aren't we talking to her on the podcast? So welcome to the podcast, Karen James.
Hi.
So how did you get involved in the Kawasaki disease thing?
So I have been doing research since fellowship in vasculitis. And one of my mentors was Peter Merkel at the University of Pennsylvania. And these guidelines were built out of the American College of Rheumatology and Vasculitis Foundation's plans to do guidelines for 7 different forms of vasculitis. And so he proposed my name as somebody to be on the literature research team for it. And I actually was the only pediatric rheumatologist on the literature research team, which was an honor.
That's wonderful. Yeah. We're going to talk vasculitis the next couple of weeks, and then we're going to talk about some sort of general rheumatology principles. Are you ready?
Oh, I'm ready.
Where are you from originally, Karen?
I'm from Massachusetts, just outside of Boston.
Outside of Boston. And then so you obviously did your fellowship at Penn. So where did you train before that?
So I went to medical school at Tufts in Boston, and I did my residency in Rochester, New York.
Can you answer a question for me? I've never understood why the hospital at Tufts, isn't it called the Floating Hospital?
Yes. So the Floating Hospital was called the Floating Hospital because it was actually originally an actual boat.
Oh, really?
And so they used to take the sick kids out on the boat during the day to get fresh sea air. And so that's why it was called the Floating Hospital. Some people thought it was because the way the building is built, it floated over one of the streets, but it's actually because it literally used to be a boat.
Holy cow. I feel smarter already. And we haven't even started talking about rheumatology. All right, Karen, let's dive in. So first of all, do you have any disclosures?
I have nothing to disclose.
Excellent. So let's start up. Why did we need a new guideline for Kawasaki disease?
So these guidelines were actually, as I said, built as part of the American College of Rheumatology Vasculitis Foundation's guidelines for 7 different forms of vasculitis. And the goal behind these guidelines was not to replace the American Heart Association guidelines, but to supplement them more for those issues that a rheumatologist may tend to get involved in. So as you know, Kawasaki is actually typically in most places not owned by rheumatology. It's cared for by cardiology, hospitalists, infectious disease, and sometimes rheumatology. And so this was to help support rheumatologists in the scenarios they're more likely to get pulled into.
And again, full disclosure, the guidelines were published in 21. Is that right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so yep. They're a couple of years old now. So what do we know about both the epidemiology and pathogenesis of Kawasaki disease, because they've always struck me as fairly mysterious?
Yes. So epidemiologically, estimates in the U.S. are that it occurs in about 9 to 20 per 100,000 kids under the age of 5. It varies depending on which study you do. The rates are much higher in Japan and Korea. European rates are a little lower depending on which country you look at and which type of study. And then it's much lower in sub-Saharan Africa. In terms of pathogenesis, there are a lot of theories out there, and there's a lot of epidemiologic data that supports to some extent a lot of the theories, but doesn't prove any of them. So what happens is there seems to be seasonal effects from Kawasaki, for example. So in the US, it tends to peak in the winter, late winter, early spring. In Japan, there seem to be peaks in January and July. And so there's some seasonality. There's some suggestion that there are infectious triggers, but nothing that they've clearly been able to prove any specific one infection is the trigger. There are these fantastic studies about tropospheric winds and how patterns of increased rates in Kawasaki kind of travel from Asia over back across into the US and then over to Europe, which suggests that there may be something being carried on these winds. And thoughts are it's an infectious trigger, an airborne pathogen, possibly something fungal or a toxin that when it hits the right susceptible person, it sets this off. There's probably some role for genetics too. We just don't know. It's probably something that's multifactorial.
And what do we know about the prognosis of Kawasaki disease?
So as you know, most kids with Kawasaki survive. They do really well. A lot of the prognosis relates, long-term relates to whether or not there was coronary involvement and how severe the coronary involvement was. So anytime you have inflammation in a blood vessel, you cause changes in the endothelial wall, and that can cause changes in shear force and risk for clot. When that's in the coronary artery, that's what causes a heart attack. And so patients who've had coronary artery involvement are at risk later in life for having cardiovascular events. A lot of the long-term data in terms of prognosis for Kawasaki disease has really been studied in those patients who have had really giant coronary artery aneurysms, so the worst of the worst. There's a study out of Japan, an older study, that shows that in adults, Japanese adults who have had giant coronary artery aneurysms, keeping in mind that those are the ones who survived into adulthood, the 10-year cardiovascular event-free survival is only 52% for males and 75% for females. So there's actually a pretty high rate of them having heart attacks. We don't have as great data on patients who have smaller aneurysms that regress or who have milder coronary changes that may not be as well detected. But there is some thought that those people may be at slightly increased risk as they get older to have a heart attack. There are always reports of adults who show up in young adulthood who have a heart attack, and lo and behold, they do imaging and they go, wow, you have coronary artery aneurysms. Why do you have coronary artery aneurysms? And they probably had Kawasaki when they were younger and it just didn't get detected.
Going back briefly to the epidemiology, what's the age distribution? Is there a...
Age distribution, so it's peak from 6 months to 5 years of age. We do sometimes see slightly older kids, and we do see some kids that are younger. Oftentimes, the youngest of the kids are harder to diagnose, and the kids that are older than the typical age range are less likely to have classic complete symptoms and maybe a little harder to diagnose. And so there seems to be some increased risk for coronary artery aneurysms and poor outcomes in those patients.
And of course, one of the sobering things there is looking at that age group, we expect them to be using their coronary arteries for decades and decades,
yep.
Which I think puts a little bit more fear in all of us.
Yeah. And, you know, we talk about how they get the coronary aneurysms, and with the exception of the giant coronaries, many of them remodel and they go back down to a normal caliber lumen. But we actually don't know really what's going on inside that vessel and if that's really the same endothelium that is usually there. So they may have some subtle abnormalities even when things normalize.
Interesting. Okay, so let's talk about the diagnosis of Kawasaki disease, because it's one of those one of those diseases where it's a checklist.
Yep.
And the number one thing is fever, which is the thing I think that puts terror in all of our hearts, because kids have fevers.
Yep. Well, and you know, I always look at the diagnostic criteria for Kawasaki and I go, how many kids with a viral illness look exactly like this, particularly adenovirus?
Right.
And so sometimes it can be hard to differentiate, and that has implications in terms of research, because I suspect there are some kids who get labeled Kawasaki who didn't have Kawasaki, who had a viral infection, and some kids who get called viral infection who probably really had Kawasaki. But the fever in Kawasaki, at least classically, tends to be high, persistent, often not responsive to antipyretics. And those kids are, generally speaking, really irritable. They're really angry. They can actually have an aseptic meningitis, and that's why they get so grumpy. They just really don't feel well.
Gotcha. And then the other criteria are 4 out of 5.
Yep, 4 out of 5.
Right.
So,
four-fledged diagnosis.
Okay. So the most common is the mucosal changes. So early on, it would be erythema and cracking of the lips, the strawberry tongue, and or erythema of the oral or pharyngeal mucosa. And that can happen in more than 90%, even the classic cases and the incomplete. So that's the most likely one you're going to see. There's the bilateral bulbar conjunctival injection. And so The conjunctivitis of Kawasaki is actually non-exudative, so you shouldn't see crusting or goop coming from their eyes. And it's what we call limbic sparing. So you'll actually potentially see almost like a white ring around the iris because the conjunctivitis doesn't actually extend to the iris. That's the limbus. And so those are the classic features. It's often actually caused by an anterior uveitis. It's not something that causes long-term issues or damage, so we don't generally do anything about it. We don't have opto come see them because it resolves, but it is something that's there. And sometimes when we have kids we're not sure about, we actually will have opto come look at them. And if it looks like an anterior uveitis, that actually helps support the diagnosis.
And I'm going to cut to the chase a little bit here, and that's that one of the things about Kawasaki, as with so many of the other diseases that you deal with, is that a lot of collaboration makes sense.
Yep.
Because they are confusing by nature and a little bit terrifying.
Yep, exactly.
Okay, so we've got the mucosal changes and the conjunctival changes.
Yep, and that's in about 80 to 90% of kids that we've seen that. So then you've got the erythema and edema of the hands or feet, which happens kind of in the acute first couple of weeks stage. And then the periungual desquamation in the subacute phase. So that's the peeling fingers. And when the peeling fingers happen, it often starts kind of right under the margin where the fingernail starts at the tip of the finger, and then they kind of peel backwards over there, almost like a degloving kind of appearance to it. So we often will look kind of along the tip of the finger, the skin right under the tip of the fingernail when we're looking for the peeling. That happens in about 85% of classic Kawasaki patients, but only in about 60% of patients who have incomplete Kawasaki.
Okay.
I always find that one a little tricky in the hospital too, especially in the acute phase, because these kids come in, they're sick, they get a bunch of fluid, and then their hands and feet are puffy.
Sure.
And so that one I always find a little tricky to tell.
How pronounced is the erythema typically?
It varies. Right. I don't always see the erythema, to be honest with you, but you can.
That doesn't make me feel reassured.
No.
Okay.
A lot of hemming and hawing in rheumatology.
Yeah. High stakes hemming and hawing. Okay, then which comes next?
We've got the rash. So the rash in Kawasaki can be just about anything. It's referred to as polymorphous. So classic is your macular, maculopapular rash. It can be more biliform. It can be scarlatiniform. You can see targetoid, urticarial, and even rarely pustular rashes. Basically, the only thing it isn't is vesicular or bullous.
Okay.
Pustular would give me a little bit of pause, and I'd want somebody to kind of weigh in on it, but it can be just about anything. It can be erythrodermic. They can just look red. It's just all over the place. And that's about 90% of classic Kawasaki, but only about 50% of the incomplete Kawasaki patients have it.
Okay.
And then finally is the least common manifestation, which is the cervical adenopathy. So the cervical adenopathy can happen, seen in about 40 to 50% of classic Kawasaki and only about 10% of the incomplete Kawasaki. And the classic description is unilateral, single node, cervical, and it has to be greater than 1.5 centimeter. So we don't see that as commonly, but it is one of the criteria. It's not usually diffuse. So if you've got a kid who's got adenopathy all throughout their neck, that's unlikely to be Kawasaki, although it doesn't completely rule it out.
And given that the presence of the other four was in the 85-90% range, it seems like, and it's four to make five, they're usually going to have the other four if they have
And sometimes, you know, they make it with the adenopathy, but it can vary. There's also kind of a lot of other non-criteria things that are out there that kind of make me go, gee, maybe this really is Kawasaki, especially if I'm kind of hemming and hawing about some of the other things like hydrops of the gallbladder. You can see diarrhea, abdominal pain. I've seen kids with orchitis. And these kids can actually get arthritis too. So sometimes they do get joint pain, and that can happen earlier or later in the course of the disease.
Okay. But we should feel reassured because if they don't have complete Kawasaki disease, there's no concern.
Nope. So then we have the incomplete Kawasaki criteria, and the American Heart Association actually has a really great algorithm to kind of take you through working through criteria for incomplete Kawasaki and when you should suspect it. So kids who are younger than 6 months or who are older are more likely to present with incomplete Kawasaki. The algorithm involves having at least two or three of the criteria, but less than four. And you go through, and it's based on having compatible inflammatory markers, And there's other lab criteria, including anemia for age, platelets greater than 450,000 on day 7 or later. So the platelets are actually slow to go up. So it can take time for some of those to go up. So just because they're normal earlier doesn't mean that they're not going to be elevated. Having an albumin of less than 3, a white count of greater than 15,000, and more than 10 white blood cells per high-powered field on a UA. And the UA is actually an interesting one. People sometimes try to do just a dipstick, but the sterile pyuria of Kawasaki disease is actually secondary to a urethritis. So first of all, you can't get away with doing a cath specimen because you're going to miss it.
Right.
So you really actually should do a bag, and it's predominantly lymphocytes. And so they're not going to make the Leuk esterase. So they're not going to turn the Leuk esterase positive. So you really need to do the micro, and you really need to do a bag or a clean catch for this.
So in other words, we've got a kid with a mysterious fever. And so if we're looking for the difference between Kawasaki and a pyelo, we sort of have to approach it from two separate trains of thought.
And you can see Leuk esterase because they may have Leuk esterase for another reason. You know, I feel like, I don't know, at least 50% of the UAs I get have a tiny bit of Leuk esterase in them, to be honest with you. But if they have a high white count, but not a lot of Leuk esterase, there's no bacteria seen, then more suspicious for sterile pyuria in those cases.
And what about echo?
Echo, if you see coronary changes, that can help confirm a diagnosis too, with the caveat being there are some rare situations where you can get mild coronary dilations and other inflammatory diseases, but that's usually something that we sort out with the cardiologist if it seems like something else. But generally speaking, if you see a true coronary artery aneurysm, then that helps confirm the diagnosis. I will say we have these criteria for classic Kawasaki and for incomplete Kawasaki. There are occasionally the rare patients who just don't meet all of those. The AHA guideline, I'd like to point out, has a clear path on the algorithm for infants less than 6 months of age. An infant of less than 6 months of age who has had a fever of more than 7 days should get an echo. Sometimes their only symptom is fever. I might argue if you have an infant of less than a year, you may even want to consider it, although it's not on the guidelines. Those are the kids that I've seen historically that have giant coronary artery aneurysms, and I worry about.
Right. For all the reasons you talked about earlier. And so you talked about Kawasaki disease and incomplete Kawasaki disease, and then acute Kawasaki disease, that these are the kids who haven't had prolonged fever yet, but may have things that lead us to believe.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of debate about what to do for those kids. So there's a couple of older studies from a while back that show that if you treat kids with Kawasaki before day 5, they are more likely to have either persistent fever or recrudescent fever and need to be retreated. They're not at increased risk for getting coronary artery changes, but they may need to be treated again. It's challenging to interpret that data because there's a little bit of confounding by indication. If you have a kid that you're sure has Kawasaki on day 3 or 4, maybe they're a little sicker, right? Than a kid that you sit for a few days waiting and watching to see what happens. And so it's hard. My inclination, if I were to choose, is I'd err on the side of treatment. I'd rather have to retreat a kid than risk a kid developing coronary artery changes. But it is a challenge. You know, with MISC, which had a lot of overlap with Kawasaki disease, we treated a lot of the kids at day 2 or 3, even though they kind of were more Kawasaki-like, and they seemed to do well, but that's kind of anecdotal evidence.
Do you want to enlighten us a little bit about macrophage activation syndrome?
Sure. Macrophage activation syndrome is a hyperinflammatory state. Some people sometimes refer to it as secondary hemophagocytic lymphohistiocytosis, or HLH.
That trips off the tongue.
Yeah, right. Rheumatology likes to call it MAS. Hematology oncology tends to call it HLH. There's debate as to whether or not they're the same thing on the same spectrum and end common pathway. But generally speaking, what it is it's a hyperinflammatory response to another inflammatory cause. And so MAS generally happens secondary to something else that is inflammatory, an infection, an autoimmune disease, or a malignancy. And usually when it's malignancy, it gets referred to as secondary HLH. And it's a form of cytokine storm. The immune system's kind of gotten itself turned on and it's having a hard time shutting itself off. We don't have criteria for MAS secondary to Kawasaki disease, but kind of signs of it are seeing hyperferritinemia, cytopenia. So Kawasaki, you usually get high platelets, high white count, lots of inflammation. In this situation, you might get a normal or a low normal or a low white count. You might have normal or low platelets. They tend to have persistent fever, which could be difficult to differentiate from just Kawasaki in general. They may be more refractory to treatment. They can have splenomegaly. Other things we sometimes see is they can get a low fibrinogen because in MAS, there's a propensity to consume fibrinogen. Sometimes it's balanced out by the overproduction in the hyperinflammatory state, but sometimes it gets low. And when you drop your fibrinogen, you'll actually also drop your sed rate. So those will be kids who sometimes have a really high CRP, but kind of a modest or barely elevated sed rate. It can cause liver inflammation. In some cases, when it's really bad, it can look like DIC or sepsis, and it can be life-threatening.
Well, that's reassuring.
It's a rare manifestation. So when we kind of talk about MISC, a lot of the MISC patients looked like they had some features of Kawasaki and some features of MAS. Kind of, they tended to be on the MAS spectrum of inflammation with this kind of consumptive process, as opposed to the really raging high inflammation of more classic Kawasaki.
Gotcha. Let's talk about treatment, because treatment does make a difference in Kawasaki, right?
It does. So untreated, the risk of coronary artery aneurysms is somewhere around 15 to 25%. With treatment, we've decreased the risk to less than 5%, which is great.
Huge.
There's obviously still room for improvement, but we've made a lot of headway. So it is important to treat Kawasaki.
So who should get IVIG?
In the US, IVIG is considered standard of care for all patients with Kawasaki. And there's good, strong, high quality evidence that shows it decreases the risk of coronary artery aneurysms. And the downside being that it's expensive, but we do recommend it for everybody who has Kawasaki, or you're fairly certain they have Kawasaki.
That would be complete or incomplete.
Yeah. I would say sometimes, you know, we talk about all these criteria, but oftentimes when you see a real patient, there's a lot of hedging. I tend to lean on the side of treating when in doubt, because I think IVIG is a relatively low risk medicine. It's expensive, but I think it's relatively low risk. And I'd rather prevent a coronary artery aneurysm than possibly miss a case.
Absolutely. Which kids need steroids?
That is a great question. So there is good data, a lot of it coming out of Japan, that shows that using adjunctive glucocorticoids upfront in patients who are high risk decreases their risk of developing coronary artery aneurysms. The problem is we have a hard time defining high risk in North American populations. So there's great risk scores that are in use in Japan and work really well there. When they try to use those risk scores in the US, they actually don't work very well. So we have some factors that have been identified as being associated with high risk. So one of them is being less than 6 months of age. One of them is having a coronary, left anterior descending or a right coronary that has a Z score of greater than 2 on the initial echo. Having a CRP of greater than 13 is another risk factor, but we're still trying to sort that out in the US. Certainly a kid who already has a coronary artery aneurysm on the first echo is high risk, because they've already got one and you want to keep it from getting worse. But we're still kind of sorting that out. So for the purposes of these guidelines, they defined it as being less than 6 months of age or having an already dilated coronary with a Z-score of greater than 2.5, which is the cutoff for a coronary artery aneurysm. And so that's what they did for these guidelines in 2021. But we're still kind of sorting that out to figure out who might benefit from more treatment upfront.
Gotcha. What's the role for aspirin in Kawasaki disease?
So aspirin historically has been used for two reasons in Kawasaki. One is the antiplatelet effect. So to decrease the risk of clot. So you've caused changes in the endothelial wall of the coronary arteries. You also have increased platelets, increased fibrinogen, lots of inflammation. So there's increased risk for clot. So low dose aspirin, 3 to 5 mg/kg, has an antiplatelet effect. Historically, anti-inflammatory dosing has also been used as a anti-inflammatory treatment for Kawasaki disease. And that's the high dose 80 to 100 mg per kg per day. And there's a lot of really old data that shows that's beneficial, but it's become less clear over time that that's really necessary in the setting of IVIG to use that high anti-inflammatory dosing. And there's actually a few retrospective studies from several years ago that show that there's no difference in the risk for coronary artery changes when you use high versus low dose aspirin, as long as you're using IVIG. And so the recommendation from these guidelines states everybody should get aspirin. It kind of hedges a little and says the optimal dose isn't known. High dose aspirin does come with risks. There's risk for hepatotoxicity and actually for hearing loss. And so we want to keep that in mind. I think there's been more of a push to use at least the medium dose aspirin, the 40 to 60 mg per kg per day, to have some anti-inflammatory effect. But we may, in a few years when new guidelines are done, it may shift towards just using the antiplatelet dosing. So it used to be that you'd use the anti-inflammatory dosing until the kids had defervesced, and then you dropped it to the antiplatelet dosing. But we may just start with the antiplatelet dosing in the future.
Interesting. But
the guidelines haven't updated to this point.
What's the role for all the other novel anti-inflammatories and biologics that fill your world with
that fill my world? The jury is still out on how a lot of those work. They're generally reserved for super high risk or refractory cases. So often frontline is IVIG, sometimes with or without steroids, depending on whether or not the patient is thought to be high risk. Frequently, if the patient relapses or has recurrent fever afterwards, they often do a second dose of IVIG with steroids. And then when you kind of go down the spectrum and patients aren't responding, or they, you know, they've defervesced, but they have coronary arteries that are changing, that's when we start using things like infliximab, anakinra, sometimes cyclosporin gets used, and even on occasion in really severe cases, cyclophosphamide.
Interesting. Anything else that you think we ought to know? What about the long-term follow-up? What follow-up do kids need?
Long-term follow-up, the main part of long-term follow-up is cardiology follow-up. And the duration kind of depends on the cardiac involvement. So if you have a kid who's low risk, never had any coronary changes, they might say after 8 weeks, you don't need to see us back. They definitely follow them out for at least 8 weeks, because the coronary artery changes are in the subacute phase from 2 to 8 weeks usually, although sometimes they show up earlier. Some people propose that because of the theoretical risks from hard to quantify endothelial changes in the vessels, that maybe they should be seen once every 5 years, but there's not a standard per se for long-term care. Kids who have giant coronary artery aneurysms or who have coronary artery aneurysms are going to get long-term follow-up in cardiology. They don't tend to need long-term immune suppression, however. This is kind of what's described as a self-limited syndrome. If we didn't treat it, it would actually go away on its own over the course of several weeks. The problem is what it's going to do before then. And that's right. Why we treat it, not because we need to treat it to make it go away, but because it's going to cause problems before it does.
Well, eventually forest fires go out too, but, exactly. But the point is what happened in the meantime.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. Anything else that you think we haven't talked about with Kawasaki? This has been fascinating. You know, it's something that has been around for a long time that I think we understand a teeny bit better, but it seems like the treatment has really given us more room for optimism.
Yeah, I think so too. Now, I think we covered kind of the basics.
All right. Well, for those of you who are left with questions, please send your questions to questions@vcurb.com. We'll talk about those in a couple of weeks. In the meantime, Karen James, thanks for spending a few minutes with us today. And we'll plan on talking to you next week if you've got time.
That would be great. Looking forward to it.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.